There's no better time than summer to visit the Finger Lakes wine region in upstate New York. And if you are a sommelier, wine retail professional, or beverage writer working anywhere in the world, I've got an invitation for you. From July 21st through July 23rd, experience majestic Finger Lakes vineyards, wines, regional cuisine, and the people behind it all with the New York Wine and Grape Foundation. There'll be hands-on experiences, lots of time in the vine rows and wineries, and the vignerons will be right there to learn from. This is a chance to go beyond book knowledge and to see the region for yourself. You'll be in a particularly beautiful part of the world and among other super motivated wine folks just like yourself. Also, there is no cost to you. Transportation and lodging will be provided. In-depth experiential learning will be organized for your benefit, and you'll have plenty of time to take in the breathtaking views of some of the world's deepest lakes. Fill out the form you can find at nydrinksny.com/LEVI with your job title and contact information, and you'll receive more information about this distinctively New York opportunity for beverage professionals. That's nydrinksny.com/LEVI if you are interested in traveling to the Finger Lakes region in New York State. Here's what buyer Tim Farrell of Brooklyn Wine Exchange had to say about his visit. I feel like we covered more on the history and terroir of the region in 2.5 days than we do on trips to other regions that last 3 times as long. As attendees, we really got to see a serious lineup of producers, and it was a supremely enjoyable and educational trip. Apply for your spot today. I'll Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today. Ben LaRue of Benjamin LaRue, based in Beaune in Burgundy. Hello, sir. How are you?
Hello. Very good, Levy.
It's nice to see you. So you have a winery in Beaune now, but you actually grew up in Beaune as well.
Yeah, I haven't moved very far, actually. I grew up in Beaune, was born there in 1975. My family is attached to Beaune, but family had absolutely no vineyards. But my parents had a flower shop. So I started the wine school in Beaune in 1990. I was just 15. And with the wine school, you need to do a bit of apprenticeship. It's not much, but I think the first year was like 9 weeks. So harvest time, pruning time, you know, to see a bit of all the work which are going around the vineyards. And as I've got two older brothers, you know, were like going out into town, Pascal Marchand was also liking to go out in town. So they knew each other. They were all friends. And when it happened that I was looking for an estate, Pascal was said straight away, yes. Meeting Pascal, it definitely like brought me his passion. Pascal arrived in Burgundy in 1985.
Because he's from Quebec.
He's from Quebec, yeah. He was probably looking for himself in Quebec and decided with two friends to go and do harvest in Burgundy because it was seems fun. They did like wine at the time, huh? And went to do harvest, and then he met his first wife, and he never left. So not coming from a wine background, done a year of quick studies at Beaune College, and then the Comte Armand was looking for someone, and he was there.
So in the late 80s, he became the head winemaker at Comte Armand, the Clos d'Epinal producer.
Yep. Yeah. So it was something quite new. And I think that's something great from the Comte Armand. If you look back at the history of that estate, he always like took very young with not much background. I think it was quite brave. I mean, looking back, he's done that with Pascal. They hired me. I was just 24 without much experience, you know, a bit of experience in different places, but not as a manager.
Because you succeeded Pascal eventually.
I succeeded Pascal, yeah. Not much experience. And if it was me, I always ask myself, you know, now I'm running a business. How should I see it in the future? Imagine, I mean, I'm not doing it for my kids, but if one of them wants to carry on, I will help. But will I be brave enough to take someone without any experience from a very young age. And I think he's been right, and he's been pretty good so far. And I quite like that idea.
Because the thing about Pascal is he was largely self-taught, as you referred to.
Yeah, he was definitely self-taught, yeah. But talented. He had no background in the wine, so his mind was totally free. And he had the freedom to express, you know, his idea and with an eye, an overview, which coming from outside. So for him, he was coming from Quebec, you know, all new, and every idea was like, you know, fresh and new. He's done a lot for Burgundy, you know. He was part of his generation, like with Dominique Lafont, Christophe Roumier. This generation, you know, was like the first one to make a real transition on in like the Burgundy wine landscape. First people to travel, you know, to go elsewhere. But for me, imagine, I arrived there at 15, and 15 is also teenage time. At teenage time, you're looking for yourself, of course. You don't know exactly who you are, who you want to be. And the key person are super important. So started with Pascal. Pascal brought me like his passion. At the time, he was one of the first to go to Biodynamic.
This was the 90s that he did that.
Wait, but imagine, like for many estate, people were talking about it, because at the time it was mostly chemical, with herbicide to biodynamic, you know, and that was typically Pascal. There's no in between with Pascal. It's very extreme. And he went like from the estate was, you know, managed not a bad way, but managed like it was in the 80s. And suddenly he said, no, we're changing and we're going to biodynamic. That gave me definitely my first direction into work, which was definitely organic and biodynamic. That said, you know, I grew up when in the family, you know, when we had to fix, you know, little disease or things like that, it was always homeopathy, organic, and using plants. So I grew up a bit this way.
And your parents were flower merchants.
You're using every part of your life, you know, because I remember working, you know, after school, you know, like peeling the roses and preparing the flower. All those aroma, you know, it was just fantastic. I love that. I really love that. See, it's always about smell.
I remember we talked about Griot one time, and you mostly talked about aroma. And I think when people usually talk about Chambertin Cruz, that's not the first thing that they talk about.
Griot is a bit special, is a bit apart. From all the cru, it's a different section of the Grand Cru of Gevrey. But quite an amazing wine to make. It's a very intriguing place. You know, the first time I made a Griot was 2011. And I was feeling a bit lost the first time. And it took me 3 vintages to re-understand the place. And that's the great thing. That's actually what I like on the negos side and purchasing fruit in many different places. It's to me the way to really understand the diversity and variety of terroir that Burgundy has. So I multiply, you know, the amount of wine I'm making. I'm making a lot of cuvée with 1 barrel, 2 barrels, 3 barrels. But it's such a joy, you know, it's such a joy to be able to touch all those different places.
Well, this is the relational aspect of terroir, where one thing is not one thing. It's different than this other thing. So to understand one wine, you have to try several in a way.
Definitely.
So the thing about you is you traveled pretty extensively in that period between when you first worked with Pascal Marchand and when then you came back. So you were in New Zealand, you were in South America, you were in Bordeaux, you were in Oregon, and you worked with Jadot for a while in Burgundy, right?
Yeah, definitely. I'm talking of my apprenticeship. So 1990 to 1993. First of all, one of the great experiences I had was to work with an experimental section about new technique in organic growing. We were working on a little spider called Typhlodromus pyrrhi. It's actually the start of people realizing that the ecosystem's working naturally. So, you know, at the time there were issues with like red spider, yellow spider in the vineyard. So people were still had to use insecticide and not the best one. I don't know if there's a good one actually, but it was not great. And there were one guy who said, you know, actually, if you don't use this insecticide, there's another spider who can actually eat those other spider, and you'll be fine. And 1992 was the early beginning. But then after now, I mean, no one's using those insecticides because we know how to protect those spider. And that was great. You know, I mean, I've started to see really, really inside, you know, what we can do in the ecosystem and linked with biodynamy, because biodynamy is more philosophy than a technique, but it's teaching you how to observe. And then I was wanting to go elsewhere. So meeting Véronique Drouin and said, we have this estate in Oregon, we can send you there, you know, and we're taking always like a couple of interns every year. And I went there in 94. Amazing, amazing vintage in Oregon. Such a great experience. And it was so good that in 95, I called Véronique. I said, you know, can I come again? She said, of course, you know, we'll keep the same team. So I did a second vintage over there. Then meeting Véronique, I said to her, you know, I'd love to have another experience, but outside Burgundy and maybe with something else than Pinot and Chardonnay. And she said, oh, actually, you know, I've got great contact in Bordeaux with Cos des Tournelles. And she kindly wrote a letter to Bruno Prats, and I was in.
What was that experience like?
It was great. I've learned a lot about a very different region, you know, like when you grow up, you know, Bordeaux, Burgundy, not closest friends. That was back in the 90s. I think that has changed a lot since. But a very, very different philosophy, working with various variety, blending. And that teach me a lot in terms of, it did enlarge a lot my aromatic spectrum and my way of seeing things. Where in Burgundy, we like single vineyards and like you don't talk about blending. But sometimes if you have a larger plot, such as Clos des Épineaux, from my own experience, it did bring me a lot on the blending experience.
You came back in the late 90s and you became the head winemaker at Clos des Épineaux, which is in Pommard.
I came back in 99. Again, it's always a question of like chance and to be there at the right time and to be available at the right time and to make also the right choice. And you only know after. But Pascal called me and said, you know, actually, I want to leave. Boissy's got a very great project with La Vougeray, and I think I'm going to leave. And are you interested by taking over Contarmont? Of course, yes. And the Comte Armand called me. That was on the 14th of July, 1999. Bastille Day.
So your first harvest at Comte Armand in Pommard was the 1999 vintage. And by that time, under Pascal, they had also purchased parcels in Volnay, Auxay, and elsewhere.
Yeah, at the time in 99, the estate was 10 hectares. 10 hectares, so a bit of white. With Meursault Méchaveau, Haussé Durès, a bit of Bourgogne and Aligoté. And of course, Volnay, Haussé Durès in red and Clos des Épineaux, which was more than half the estate. And 99, you know, 99, what a vintage to start. My issue was more to find the space to put all the fruits in the winery. Contrairement, the winery was made only for the Clos des Épineaux, so with all those extra vineyards and with quite a large crop, like 99. It was really tight, really tight. But the great thing with that estate, actually, with beautiful building, 15th century, but the wall, you can't move the wall over there, they're 1 meter large. It teach me how to deal with a small space. And that was quite good. In 2000, part of the vineyards went back to their owner because some vineyards were rented. And suddenly, I had no more whites to do. And to me, I always love making both, red and white. In 2000, I really missed not having any whites to make. And came back like 6 months after harvest to the Comte Armand and said, I really loved making the Meursault and Haussé Durès. And I mean, he said, yeah, that's Ben, you know, be a bit patient. We will found more vineyards. And actually, there were a couple of vineyards for sale. But the Comte Armand was not the only one to decide because you have all the family around. And it didn't happen. And I came back to him and said, you know, why are we not starting micro-negos just in fruit? You know, let's see what we can make. We have 2 years to decide if, you know, the quality is good enough to sell it on the Comte Armand name. To have no confusion, we will do only whites. Because like this, you know, the estate is red, the negos is white. And he said, yeah, why not? Let's start. And it was my first approach on purchasing fruit. So we started in 2001 with 3 barrels of Ossé Durès. So we started gently in 2002, seeing that it was working. And we had anyway, we had the winery, we had the tool. We increased the volume, you know, around 50, 60 barrels, only with 3 appellations up to 2006. And at some point I said, you know, it was not enough to me. White was one thing, but I was wanting to go a bit elsewhere and, of course, touch a few fruits from the Côte de Nuit and the Pinot, where suddenly that's creating a confusion between Comte Armand and it's an historic name. You know, it's got more than 200 years of history. You can't do whatever, you know, for at least for the brand. So in 2006, I was hunting by a famous estate in Burgundy, and to be fair, you know, it was like quite nice, you know, to see that people will think about you to run their place. And I mean, it's another great name on my experience. But 2006, I was 31, and to me, it was hard to leave a job that I've started, because in 99, I mean, the estate was not entirely biodynamic. I mean, I straight away converted, I've done the conversion, it was certified after, and it takes more time. So I said to the Comte Armand, I'm happy where I am, I'm not looking for more money, but can I have more freedom to do something on the side and to create my own micro-negos, because I think here it's too limited. And if you agree, you know, I'm happy to stay another 5 years and not take the job. So he didn't think much, you know, it was like less than 1 minute. He said, you know what, I agree, but you stay another 10 years. So in the end, you know, we split in two. So I stayed another 7 years at Comte Armand while I was like building my own brand.
Because you were there through 2014 and you started Benjamin Leroux around 2007.
Yeah. I've done seven vintage with both.
Before we move on to your own project, you know, I visited Comte Armand Claude Epinot one time, but I don't know a lot about it, and I think you do. So if I understand correctly, it's a walled vineyard, so a clos, but it encapsulates within that clos both Grand and Petit Epinot, which are separate vineyard crews.
Yeah, Claude Epinot is... It's definitely a clos. Huh? It's 2.50 meters wall around. We have a letter, you know, where the wall was finished in 1805 during French Revolution. Quite amazing, huh, for an aristocratic family. It was part of the Marémange. They've been able, you know, to preserve all the belonging during that time, and it went to the Armand family as a wedding gift. You know, it's what we call a dot. 5.23 hectares, to be exact. It's definitely in between Grand and Petit Epinot. You have a half an hectare of Grand Epinot. The rest is in Petit Epinot. But that said, here you are talking about the lieu-dit. Clos des Epinots is also an appellation. It is an appellation. So it's not only a name which is given. But if we want to declassify, we can call Petit Epinot, yeah, or Grand Epinot. Let's say there were like 4 main blocks. 2 on the top, 2 at the bottom. With different age of vine, too. First of all, you know, 5.2 hectares, you can't ferment all of them in the same tank. Then they've done quite a good job in the past by replanting bit by bit. And Pascal, when he started, yeah, Domaine des Epinots was just one wine and one vineyard. So at some point, you know, it was super interesting to divide. And also he was playing on it also for the tasting, because people were coming to your place and they were just one wine to taste. So that's the interesting part. And I'm using it a lot today, because imagine if that vine's been divided like many vineyards have been. People will say, you know, well, the bottom of the Clos des Epinots is not the most interesting part. The top is the best. I made wine from every single block. When I've started, you know, Pascal was mostly working with five. I decided to divide it even more. I went to eight different cuvées. And at some point, all the time, you know, I mean, I've done small bottling of each block to keep, not to sell. And each time we've done, you know, like blind tasting of all the different blocks, in the end, the final blend was always the best. And you could see it on many, 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 many different ways. The people who build the wall around, you know, they did it quite well. We've done geological analysis on both sides of the wall. You know, the walls are not straight, and they're really following the geological fault. And yes, you have a bit of Grand Pneu with a different geology, actually. But those vineyards are meant to be together. And that's important on the fruit purchase, because I'm not only especially looking, you know, for the best spot on top with the older vine. And I like when I've got a bit of everything, because you're touching really the expression of the terroir and the best balance. You're always talking about the Clos Vougeot. I'm making single vineyards in Clos Vougeot because I don't have access to all the diversity, but I'd love to make a Clos Vougeot with all the different parts, because yeah, the top might be better than the bottom, but I think all together it will make a much, much better wine. The true image usually is the entire place. So it's something I'm reproducing a lot on my wine when I can.
For example, when you do village wines, so like a Gevrey village or a Volnay village, you blend and you blend different parcels and you'll treat those parcels differently. You'll do whole cluster on one vineyard more than in another vineyard, and then you'll blend them together. And there'll be different clonal materials or massal, and there'll be different vine ages when you do that.
Sure. I'm talking of village wine. I love like bringing a bit of purchase from a different place to be able to have all the diversity of actually the appellation. Again, it's one experience I had with Clos des Epneaux, because the Volnay village at the beginning, I was able to make a great one once every 5 years. Because where it's located, it could be great, but it could be average. It's when we started to purchase other vineyards, we choose exactly where. And when we add the two together, we were able to make great Volnay 4 years out of five. The first time we had some hell, you know, as we had the négoce, I've been able to purchase a bit of fruit to make the cuvée big enough to ferment, you know. And I choose on purpose a different side of Volnay, and it's probably the best Volnay we've made. Because suddenly we had all the diversity and it was much more balanced. And it opened a lot my eyes, you know. You could stick to what you have and be lucky, but if you have the opportunity to make it better, why not? Why not?
At Comte Amand, the blending wasn't just about parcels. There was also different grape varieties in the Clos. So there's Pinot Noir, but there's also a small amount of Pinot Bureau and Pinot Blanc.
It's like the old type of plantation, you know. It's first, it's a higher density, 12,000 vine an hectare, which I think was quite clever at the time and brave. With about, well, it depends on the block, but let's say 3% average of Pinot Blanc, but mostly what we call Bureau in Burgundy. And I always kept them together, you know. It's so on the sorting table, yeah, every case is, you have a few white grapes coming through. It was super important, and I'm reproducing that on the plantation I'm doing now. To understand, because sometimes we talk about tradition, and tradition is, what is tradition? It's what we can remember, you know, of how people, usually 2 generation or 3 generation. But tradition are changing, you know, it depends on the time. And it's super interesting to see why people were working one way, and maybe think why we're still working the same way, or were they working for quality reason or for practical reason. And on the old plantation, you know, that was things they were doing, but they were also doing it in white with Aligoté and Chardonnay. A bit of Aligoté in the Chardonnay was quite a common thing. I wonder sometimes if we don't restrain too much ourselves with rules. A bit of Aligoté in the Chardonnay, but I'm talking of planting, not blending after, but could be an answer for the future.
In terms of climate change, you mean?
In terms of climate change, yeah.
And Comte Amand went through a long period after a phylloxera of not being replanted. And then it was planted in the 30s. And as you said, it was planted at high density. So the questions that people were asking after phylloxera was like, how should we replant this? And you feel, to extend this thought a little bit further, that with the climate changing in Burgundy, that these are questions that are perhaps more relevant again than ever.
Yeah, they are. They are, because what I'm going to replant during my life, I won't see those vineyards at their best, because they will be at their best 50 years later. And I'd love to make it right for the next generation. We have high suspicion that in 50 years' time, it's going to be warmer in Burgundy and probably drier. So temperature is not the main concern, because I think we can adapt ourselves on the way we're growing vine. But water is the other thing, you know. I've worked also as a consultant and during a part of my life, but each time I was going somewhere where you had irrigation or thing, I said, I don't see the future there. There's no interest. How can you see those vineyards in 300 years? Because you're going to have a big lack of water. We need to adapt ourselves and see things differently. Clay definitely are interesting.
So clay soils retain water is what you're...
Yeah. Clay soils retain water. We had sign of drought in 18.
Which is rare in Burgundy, because the last time that happened was 3.
Yeah, 2003. Right?
Usually, it can be warm, like in 15, but you don't have drought, because you had rain in 15, right?
Yeah, the difference is 2003 was very exceptional, because it was like, you know, really like a heat wave. But the year 2003, overall, is not that warm. I think 2018 is 1.6 degrees average above 2003, yeah, to give an idea. 2018 is the warmest year ever recorded in Burgundy. The second warmest year is 17. The third is 15. So that's where we're going. So we need to do everything. We'll see some electric tractors. We will see, lots of things. Better sprayer, you know, maybe, you know, drone to take the weeds out. Why not? You know, new technology can bring things. But we need to adapt ourselves, I think. And we need to think about it now. Trying to do things exactly like we used to is, I don't think, is the right move. But that's, I'm talking about the viticulture side, but also the winery side. For example, you know, my cellar is getting warmer. It's not a big difference. And warmer is like 0.5 degrees. Should I put a cooling system everywhere and keep the temperature they used to be? Or maybe should I see how the wine's evolving with this change and rethink our way of aging wine? I'm all for the second option. I want to learn with what's happening and see maybe we can get good things out of it. So I don't want to resist. I'm more on the position to adapt.
When you move to organics, and sometimes you've used biodynamics, have you seen soil pH change and thus acidity change in the wines?
In terms of soil analysis, no, you won't. I mean, pH, you can have small variation, but it doesn't change it much. The change is definitely more in the wine, yeah. You can see change in the analysis of the wine with usually slightly higher acidity when you move to organic. But it's not always significant, but on the taste it is. So the feeling of freshness, you have something brighter, definitely.
One of the things you've wondered about is if through over-fertilization, people have added too much nitrogen to the soil and if that's had effects in the wines.
The vine, you know, we're cultivating vine, but the vine doesn't make fruit for our pleasure. It's a question of surviving and bringing as much energy around the seeds. When the vine doesn't have the stress to have this survival instinct, it doesn't bring much concentration around the pips, the seeds, and then you're losing the complexity. Same thing with the stem. We're talking of all cluster. If you have too much nitrogen, de-stem, because the stem will be more like green fluorescent, and that's when you can get greenness to the wine. So it's always a question of balance. The vine needs to be in balance, but also a bit stressed before achieving the ripeness of the fruit.
Just to speak about vineyards a little bit more, something you've been working on is trimming later or hedging later after flowering, and then sometimes folding, so not hedging or trimming.
It's a big question at the moment. I don't know exactly how to take the warmer weather with that side. It's true that in the past, So I was tending to trim as high as possible, as late as possible. We've done a few non-trimming. So, you know, with single post, a bit like in Cotroti, so no more wire, single post, to see where it could go. To also prepare maybe the idea of like going on much higher density, like 20,000 vine per hectare, with a kind of full plantation, so not in row. I was asking myself about the landscape we've got. You know, you're going to Burgundy, it seems the tradition. You know, you have 10,000 vine an hectare, all the row are planted 1 meter apart. So that's a post-phylloxeric landscape. They've done well at the time. Huh? Dr. Guyot was in Save Burgundy with an organic way of fighting phylloxera, huh? With just grafting. It was better than using chemicals on the soil. But, you know, is it the best way? It's done quite well, but we're only getting the secondary effect of it today. You know, it's only 100 years later. We're talking of Claude Desapneaux replanting in the 30s. We're only in 2019, so it's not even 100 years. It's not much. It's not much. So, wondering, you know, if we can maybe planting like it was before in full. I'm not the only one. Huh? There's also other growers such as Olivier Lamy doing it, and La Loubise Leroy. You know, we're always keeping an eye on what she's doing in the vineyards. Today, my question is, one of our problems is we're rising up in sugar. I don't think we will be able to keep it at 12.5 like we used to, but I'm not keen on making wine at 15% of alcohol. And I'm not sure that having more leaves is the answer. I'm re-questioning myself at the moment. And I'm not saying trimming lower is the way. And non-trimming is an interesting path, but not too high. Let's see, you know, we gain from our experience, but we don't have the answers yet.
So some of the things you've told me in the past is that if you keep the canopy and you don't hedge or trim in cold years, you can have more exposure to mildew because you have less airflow. But on warm years, you can have too quick sugars because you have more leaves, which are the motor of ripening.
That's why we haven't answered the question yet. We planted two young vine like 2 years ago, and I want them to perform in 50 years' time. Hopefully, we planted the right clone, but they were more like later ripeness. And so not the ideal maybe for the moment, but hopefully in 50 years' time, it will work.
What have you observed as other potential things you need to be looking at on the vineyard side when it comes to climate change?
It's a very large subject because we're not sure about how it will change. Warmer is one thing, but the rain average is about the same, but it doesn't fall at the same time. So that's we will learn bit by bit. But I think we definitely need to start experimenting. So we have to keep an eye on wood disease, I think. The way we're pruning, we see different way of pruning coming in. Again, it's long term. It's long term. So we should never think short term. You know, like Thai pulsar is definitely one of the way to fight against wood disease.
Which is a kind of pruning where
you respect the sap flow. You don't creating a necrosis, you know, on the sap flow where actually fungus can develop. So that's for us, but it's going back to the nursery too, you know, on the way they're grafting and where the old English grafting is coming back. Also new way of grafting. It's moving on every side of the profession. But it's like everything, you know, like they were 30 years ago, you know, some rootstock were like, seems to be the best. And 25 years later, you know, the vines are dying. And today we say, whoa, what's happening? It was, I mean, that was a very qualitative rootstock and suddenly the vines are dying. And we were not aware of it.
But in some way, these questions are related. So when you talk about trimming or not trimming, you know, that can provide more shadow for more leaves on the fruit. And you've spoken to me about the difference between sunlight versus heat and how those two things are different when it comes to grapes.
Yeah. The vine doesn't especially need heat to ripe. If you have a heat wave, what we will see is like more dehydration and concentration by dehydration. We need a bit of juice in grapes because if you have too much skin, especially with Pinot, it could be a problem. The light is the most important because every plant got its natural intern clock with light. And what's the biggest difference is with warmer weather, we have a earlier bud burst, and we can have risk of frost, early frost. But when I've learned, you know, in Burgundy, flowering were usually from 10th of June to mid-June, so just before the equinox, which means all the ripeness cycles, so the classic 100 days, we're always saying 100 days from flowering to picking, which is true, usually always worked. It's more like a question of like amount of light. When the flowering is mid-May or late May, then the vines will get a big part of its cycle on the longest day. And suddenly, you have more light, and the 100 days could work if you have very bad weather in August, but at the moment, it's not the case. I remember in 2003, you know, walking in the vineyards and everybody were on holiday, and I just bought my house, so I had to stay, and worked 1 week in the house, you know, first week of August. I went back to the vineyards because I had to take some tools at the domain. You know, I left the vineyards, the fruit were starting to change color, and 1 week later it was all dark and black. And I picked up a berry and it was quite sweet. And we were mid-August. I said, whoa, you know, what's going on? So there's something strange happening. And I called, you know, the institute, because at the time we still have the Banc des Vendanges. They were all coming back 25th of August. No one was there. I've done my own ripeness sample and said, whoa, you know, that's getting a bit crazy there.
Because in Burgundy, it's regulated when you can start picking, and that's called the Banc des Vendanges.
At the time, yeah. Now it's not official. But we a bit of a panic, and I crossed Michel Lafarge in the vineyards, and Michel said, you know, really enjoy this harvest because you will live only one time and harvest in August in your life. And that was in 2003, and I think since 2003 we started 7 times in August. But you know, we're getting used to it. We adapt ourselves to it. I think we need to be careful. Actually, the change of balance on the fruit and work a different way. It's not the same way when you work Pinot at 3.3 pH and nothing can happen. Today, like in 18, we picked some fruit at 3.7, 3.8. So more what I've seen in the new world than what we used to. But it doesn't change that the wines are gorgeous in balance.
Because something you've expressed to me in the past is that if the fruit ripens too quick for Pinot, then the phenolics are not ripe.
Yeah, you have two types of ripeness. You have physiological and phenolic ripeness, which is usually one of the issues with young vine. That's why at Clos des Epneaux, with the younger vine, we were making Pommard Village for a while, because easy to achieve, you know, sugar ripeness and acidity ripeness, then the phenol are not always at the peak of ripeness. When we roll vine, usually it's the opposite, you know, phenolic ripeness before physiological ripeness. This balance is super important. On my experiment of non-trimming and high canopy, I started to have that problem. And it was in cooler year, actually, where I was producing lots of sugar, but the phenolics were a bit later. That's for Pinot, of course. 2018 was quite interesting on that side, because I took the challenge. You know, sometimes we're looking at the analysis of like the ripening sample. I'm always tasting. I'm not looking at the analysis saying, wait, that need to be picked. But some of them, like, let's say if you look at what the lab was sending, he said, well, you know, pick. Imagine I'm on my consultant life, you know, they're sending me the analysis from Chile to Burgundy. I said, guys, you know, pick. But going in the vineyards, tasting the fruit, the skin were not ripe. And we were already at 13. So the physiological ripeness was there, but the phenolic was not there. And then he said, whoa, you know what, where are we going? And so for a couple of vineyards, we picked later with very high sugar. But the phenolics are ripe. And the wines doesn't show the alcohol. So that's, as I said early on, you know, I'm not keen for 15. I'm not keen for 15 at all. But I think we'll learn a lot about with this vintage and see. But we definitely need to move. I think that the biggest challenge is everything is long term in vineyards, as I was saying. But what happened at the moment is going super fast, and we have to react.
It's faster than the agricultural cycle.
It's much faster. It's much faster than and also than our understanding. Well, lots of challenge. I'm thinking a lot at the moment. But you know what? I don't know exactly which direction to take. So it's probably multi-direction. And we will try our best to find our path.
So much of what you said about the difference between phenolic ripeness and sugar ripeness, so much of that conversation sounded to me like the kind of thing I hear from people in the new world. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's a very common conversation there. Not something I usually associate with Burgundy.
It's always a problem I faced when I was working outside of Burgundy. And when you're traveling and you work on all those regions, you're learning a lot because the challenge is greater. And when you are back in Burgundy, you see sometimes, I mean, you see, some people working and say, well, you don't understand the chance we have here. Because even with not much knowledge, I mean, the terroir will express itself and by itself, which is nice, huh? But when you're starting to have a big variation, it's much more challenging, and it's where you have to be really, really careful. And you're right. We have a challenge. I mean, especially the last, not 17, but 18, remind me a lot of what I've seen in the new world.
So the thing about 18, which you've referred to a few times now, which was very hot vintage, is that often there was little malic acidity. And what you've explained to me in the past is that malic acidity becomes lactic bacteria through malolactic conversion. And then the lactic bacteria becomes sediment, becomes the lees. And so if you don't have a lot of malic, then you don't have a lot of lactic, then you don't have a lot of lees.
There's two things. Malic acid is a strong acid, huh? It's green apple. Lactic acid is a creamy one. Again, by tradition, you know, we learned, let's say, the average malic acid, especially when you do harvest mid-September, is more 4 to 5 grams. So with that level, you're really talking about fermentation. It's fermenting usually for 1-2 weeks or sometimes more, but you have a real change in terms of pH, acidity. The creaminess of the lactic is going around the tartric, which usually is also higher at that level. What happened in the last few vintages, there were no more malic acid. So no more malic. So let's say 1 grams or less means no lactic. Means malo is done right after the sugar, sometimes with the sugar, which means the aging is done only with yeast lees, which is a good thing, actually, because the bacterial lees are not the best. That's why after malolactic, usually we are racking. Bacteria are heavier than yeast, so it's the lees which are going really at the bottom of the barrel, and the dead yeast are more the fine lees. So in the last couple of years, we're actually only aging on fine lees, which is better. We're able to do no racking. Sometimes we will rack if we need to, but usually the racking is done after alcoholic fermentation, so when the wine is not even in barrel. And the fact that you don't have this creamy lactic acid around the tartric, and the tartric level is slightly lower, actually the balance doesn't change. The balance is good, and it leaves more expression to the tartric acid, which is more zesty, citrusy. And to be fair, I like it. I like it a lot. But we never seen that before, because you always had lactic. With white, you can block the malo and you can have the malic, but that's the first time, you know, we're able to see acid balance without much lactic or without much malic. And it's something new. It's one of the positive signs. So 15 years ago, you will have asked me the same question. I will have said, you know, like the old growers said, you know, with experience, the later is the malo, the better it is for the wine. Which means in the past, we were probably keeping the wine on fine lees for, you know, 9 months. Then you have malolactic starting in spring for a couple of weeks, and then you're racking after a year, and then you have only 6 months on fine lees at the end of the aging. Today, the last couple of vintage, we aged the wine maybe only 16 months instead of 18, or 17 months instead of 18, so not a big difference, but only on fine lees. And actually, 16 months post-malo, which is much longer than what we ever done. And I love it. And I love it for both color, white and red. And that's one of the things which is amazing me with those one vintage, because I will never have, you know, put a coin on the whites, because with the reds, the phenol, we're talking of the phenolic ripeness, and if you have a good phenolic ripeness, it works with warmer weather. But you know, the whites with warmer weather, it's not always my my cup of tea. And 17, great wine, good freshness. And 18, again, and super juicy fruit. When the Pinot, you know, had the lack of juice and high concentration of skin. But the white seems to cope very well with what's happening outside. And that's, for the moment, a mystery to me.
As the climate has changed, you, and I don't know if these two things are related, but in general, you've moved to a winemaking technique of doing less extraction on reds.
Yeah, it's global. Maybe it's climate change. It's also, I've changed also my taste. I was saying it's a life journey, you know. It's I've started in the wine gently at the age of 15. I'm 44 today. My taste has changed, you know. I was asking myself, you know, millions of questions in the past. I'm still asking myself a lot of questions, but they are easier, and I'm trying to select, you know, the best one and to achieve an answer. When before, I think I never, I was asking myself another question before I had the answer of the previous one. I like elegance now. I like elegant wine more than powerful. And when you can get both, it's great. But let's say I was more on the extraction, which was probably the move also at the, in the 90s. When today, you know, I like when you have more elegant style for both also, Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. So I'm more working in terms of infusion. At the same time, the technology are a bit different. The question about destemming or whole cluster 30 years ago is not the same than today. Today, you are able to destem and preserve the whole berry, and you can do fermentation inside the berry without the stem. And that's a big change. So you're able to preserve those spiciness and floral aroma without having the greenness of the stem. What I like with wine is when you can't guess, you know, is it old cluster? Is it this stem? And as this question is always coming to every kind of tasting, I love playing now with that in the cellar, you know, guess. Tell me, what do you think? And it's so hard actually to guess. I've got cuvée, you know, going to 80% old cluster, sometimes 100%, some are old this stem. There's no rules, you know, it could be old cluster on Bourgogne Rouge and old this stem on Grand Cru. It's what we see on the sorting table which decide what we will do.
What you like is whole berry, whether it's whole cluster with stems or whole berry that's been destemmed. And it used to be that the destemmers either broke the berry or didn't get the full stem.
Yeah.
And so now you can do more intercellular. So that allows you to destem and keep a whole berry, which you've combined with punching down at the beginning of the fermentation less. You used to punch down more at the beginning, and now you don't because you want to keep the berries whole.
Of course. If you work hard to preserve the whole berry, you won't plunge at the beginning. We let the fermentation start naturally, and it's going to go slowly inside the berry. The juice, which is there because, by the way, you know, the berry at the bottom are crushed naturally. We will wait for the end of the fermentation of this juice, so more closer from one farden, and then we start to plunge to let some of the juice from the berry, you know, getting out.
So about halfway through, or at least when there's some more alcohol as opposed to just sugar, yeah, you start to punch
down. There's no extraction with sugar. The extraction is starting with alcohol, so there's no need of plunging before. When you only got the sugar, you know, the extraction is a very, very, very little.
And this is a change from what you were doing in the 90s when you were looking for more extraction and the equipment was different.
99, Contarmont arrived. They were like the distemmer of the time, which was De Moisy at the time. It was probably one of the only builder. It was all equipped with a crusher. The speed was about 10 tons an hour. There were no sorting table at the time. So basically, you know, it's like a sorting in the vineyards. But even if you think the fruit are clean, you know, each time we picked ourselves, you know, some vineyards and we picked perfectly and we put the fruit on the sorting table. And there's always 2% of fruit that we are rejecting because what you see in the vineyards is not what you see on the sorting table, you know, with like special lights and everything. And crushing, then it was like a must pump, you know, taking the must to the tank. So basically it was like mashed fruit going into the tank. So we had skin on one side, juice on one side, and pips on the other side. So not exactly the same. So that's what we were calling destemming in the 90s. In 2001, I bought my first destemmer, like proper destemmer. It was working well, much better, but then we were using like little conveyor belt to go into the tank. Big difference in terms of tannin between the 99. So the equipment like made a big difference on the style of the wine. And then I was not happy with this destemmer, so I bought another one. And then I think today it's my sixth one in 15 years' time. But I think I found the right one. I really love it. And it's really like a for Pinot Noir. If you're a builder of destemmer, you know, many wineries got many varieties. So it needs to be able to be adaptable to different kind of variety. And you don't destem Syrah or Cabernet the same way as Pinot Noir. But voilà, my new one is not like a Demoisy. There's no crusher, of course. And it can work at the max of 1 ton an hour, and which is perfect after a sorting table. Usually we're working 600 to 800 kilograms an hour.
Back at Comptamon, back in the 90s and early 2000s, you were doing a week of cold soak. And how do you feel about cold maceration now?
I don't do it. I don't do it anymore. First by experience, because I've learned of what I've done. And I let the yeast starting themselves now. The only things I will do is, of course, if you pick in August, you might pick with warmer temperature. So we will cool down the fruit to either naturally outside, if the nights are cold, or on a cold room. And we'll bring them down to 14, 15, so not cold. But just to avoid a peak of temperature during fermentation. So the first we will pick at the winery will take probably a week to start. So they will stay for a week at 15. But then the last we will pick, when I will pick, the large Gevrey-Chambertin, for example, my Savigny will be almost at the end of fermentation at the same time. So basically, after 1 or 2 days, it's starting to ferment and it's fine. Voilà. I don't want to inoculate, with even if it's wild yeast I've had prepared. I let them go. I'm more playing on maceration after fermentation. That's a big change, because same thing, when I learned, fermentation were achieved, you had to hurry up to press because you were losing the carbon dioxide. There were no way to protect the skin or to close the tank, wooden open tank. And as soon as it was pressed, of course, mixing pre-run and pressed wine and straight into barrel with all the sediment. Today, we can seal the tank. We're preserving the natural carbon dioxide on top, and then we start the infusion, and we see when it's ready. So some maceration could be only 2 weeks total, from picking to pressing, and some could be 3.5 weeks. And it all depends on how they goes, and there's no rules. So everything is done by taste. In the morning, the team doesn't know what they're going to do. First, we're taking sample, we're tasting, and we decide.
And for red, which is not true for white, you do vertical pressing. And so for white, you do horizontal pneumatic. So why in particular do you like to do vertical press for red?
There were no question. The first time I've tried the vertical press, the quality of the press was just fantastic. First, you have to understand it's a single press. We won't rotate the skin, or so there's no mixing or mashed up. And the piston will go gently on top. But it's going on in a single time. And you're only extracting the best of the skin. And with the cake, it's making a natural screen or filtration. And it's like super clean. It's when I've tried it, I straight away bought it. Then we tried white. We tried white also. It's also the old way with white. You have to take your time because time of extraction, you have to remove the fruit many times, what we call a rebêche. We've done it with Saroma. We've done one in vertical, one in horizontal. We'll see in a couple of years, if one is aging better than the other one, or if one is getting oxidized before the other one. But I'm very happy with the pneumatic press with whites. I think it's a question of learning how to use it. It did bring lots of issues, especially when they arrived mid-90s. And if you use it, without programming yourself and adapting yourself to the fruit, and you just reproducing the same things every year, of course you can face issues. But if you learn how to use it, I won't go back to something else, because we can create great sediment with pneumatic press. To me, that's not the problem. It's more how we're using it the problem.
In red, how do you feel about topics like racking, CO2 retention, and lees contact in barrel?
Racking, I think, is an important part, but it has to be done at the right time. Nothing should be a recipe. If you have very low malic level, if the lees doesn't get reductive, I don't think there's a need to rack. When I've learned, you know, everywhere I've been working, when we were racking, there were 20 liters of lees per barrel. You know, like it was heavy and reductive. And when it was getting close from bottling, you know, we were like getting the eggs from the farm and we were putting 2 white eggs per barrel. And that was the way to do it. And we were not experimenting before. Should we put 1 egg, 2 eggs, 1.5, 1.25? No, it was 2. And, you know, sometimes it was working, sometimes not. Today, we're always experimenting. We're trying before, you know, just to check. Racking, it's only if it needs to be done. Something we've done in the last couple of years, which I really like, is not putting the wine straight into barrels. Because with the last couple of years, you know, we had drier summer, which means not much rains to clean the fruit. So probably more retention of sulfur and copper on the fruit, plus dust and dirt. We do it for white. Huh? When we press the white, we sediment the white. We do very light sedimentation, but always at the bottom of the tank. The sediment you don't want to retain, you know, they're brown, they're earthy. But with the reds now, we're doing the same thing. Pressing, it's staying 2 weeks to 1 month in tank. And actually, in a way, it's like how racking. And then we're able to get only the finest lees into the barrel. It's more the adaptation to the weather condition we had. We were somehow forced to do it. And I really like the technique, something I haven't thought, you know, before. Seems to work quite well. And since we're doing it, we rack much less. And I think in terms of aromatic, there's much more definition into the wine too. But that said, you know, like, Nuit Saint-Georges au Toré, for example, we racked it in the middle, and sometimes we rack only 1 barrel, and sometimes 2, and we have variation. They're all individual, they all got different character, they all had their history inside their own village. Again, you know, no recipe at all.
How do you feel about CO2 retention?
As we don't do racking at the moment, we're keeping lots of CO2. I like keeping high gas. And many times, you know, on my wine, you could feel a bit of fizziness when they're young. We're tending to bottle with high carbon dioxide. We usually like 100 milligrams above, you know, what we used to have. So I love bottling when we are on the edge of perception. So, you know, when they're young, you know, yeah, you will feel it. It's lifting some aromatics, and I really love it. And so it's not at all a re-fermentation. We do it on purpose. And I like it. You know, it's natural. It's helping us avoiding using too much sulfur. But it's to preserve the wine, you know, because, of course, you know, like in terms of microbiology, sometimes you need oxygen. And on top, you know, for acidic bacteria, things like that. So that's why we're using sulfur. Huh? It's an antioxidant, but it's an antiseptic first. So carbon dioxide is the way to low down sulfur level. And on top of that, as you know, especially for the whites, we're using screw cap or DM as an answer to failure with cork. And with those type of closure, you need to use less sulfur, much less sulfur.
Specifically regarding that point, one of the things that you've pointed out to me in the past is that in the 80s and 90s, early 90s, people were using less sulfur. Then there was the Premox situation. Sulfur levels went up as a response to this. And so they were adding more sulfur to try to preserve the wines. But now levels have often come back down again.
Yeah, it went quite high at the same time. So it's I think it's a good thing that it's if it's going a bit down. First, I mean, I was talking of screw cap or DM, but the cork production overall, you know, reacted to the issues that they had. I don't think it's over. I think with sulfur, you know, you were talking of the 80s. So most of the time, also, the technique of measuring sulfur were not the same. And also the technique of using sulfur into barrels. for me to keep my barrels, they don't see much sulfur in my barrels because most of the time they're full. And I think with the sulfur level, I don't want to change my wine for the closure. That's why I switched the cork to something else. I was fed up of like using 35, 40 parts of free sulfur, which to me was totally changing the identity of the wine. And most of the time it was working if, like, let's say the cork was doing a part of his job, so losing a bit of sulfur, fine. But if, as we were always looking for top cork, if the cork is like really doing the perfect seal, then you retain too much. I don't see myself, you know, like taking a gamble and, you know, with the cork. But I don't see myself also having like a triple security and going to high sulfur and say, well, if the cork is not working well, at least I've got enough sulfur. The variation in terms of quality of cork is so great that it's difficult to take a decision.
You do barrel ferments of different size for white. You also do foudre, which are large ovals of wood. And that's kind of a typical old traditional style Mâconnais fermentation to do Chardonnay and foudre like that. And now you're experimenting also with whites fermented in steel, like tank. And that would be something that you would find in Chablis, but not typically in the Côte d'Or. And what are your thoughts about that topic in general?
Alors, stainless steel, we found it in Chablis, but it's, you know, it's not a tradition. Chablis used to be in barrels, but when the vineyards extended, many people, you know, were not growers and suddenly became growers. And the easiest way to get equipped was stainless steel. Now it's the style, but that happens in the last 30 years. Food, we still found some in Mâcon, which I think they kept that tradition, but it used to be seen also in Côte d'Or. Just the only issue is that, you know, phylloxera came through that, then First World War, then, you know, economical crisis plus Second World War. So the skill went lost, and also the big maison, the big négoce were ruling the system. When we're talking of tradition, we're talking of 228 liters, so what we call the pièce. How are we using the pièce? Because it's the best volume to edge, you know, Pinot and Chardonnay. Why exactly is the reason we have those type of barrels? Usually the historical reason is purely because it's practical. It's an easy volume to move for one person, to get out of the cellar, you know, through the steps. So all the business were made in barrel. And most of the time, you know, there were lots of éleveurs, which were doing the élevage in foudre. And then they were only after using again the pièce to ship the wine. And they were sending the barrels to Paris, to Brussels, to London, and getting some empty one back. So I'm just going back to what used to be made. The main decision was also because of having higher alcohol, mean higher extraction from the wood. Today, we're able to make wine with more purity, where you have more definition of flavor. So why bringing another layer of flavor and tannin, which doesn't belong to the wine? I'm not saying you don't need new oak. There were definitely a period of time where Burgundy used too much oak. At the same time, if we look back, Burgundy was definitely needed at the time, you know, to clean out the cellar and to change the barrel, because you can't keep the barrels forever, because you can have some contamination which are not great. I'm thinking of Brettanomyces, for example. And so what happened in the 90s was not that bad. You know, it cleaned out a lot of dirty things from the cellar. But then there were a bit of loss of identity, tasting the same thing. You know, when you're a négociant, you can see from in every village some identity of wine in the village. But most of the time, because one cooper is like almost working with all the same grower, and it will be the same with nursery and vegetal material, you know, and somehow, you know, like the barrel maker is start to be part of the identity of the taste of the village. Me, I'm getting fruit from every villages, and I see it a slightly different way. So I want to use wood for the micro oxidation of the wine, but I don't want to use wood to give an identity to my wine. So most of the time, first I will mix different cooperage when I can. And with the variation of content, so it's mostly to have less wood contact within the volume of wine. So we will make differentiation, of course, between a Grand Cru, which suits well with regular barrels. I'd love to make food with the butter, but I don't produce enough anyway. But also the second aspect of what I'm doing, you were talking of oval shape and round shape, is to work also on the shape of content and see what is the effect on the movement of lees and what's the effect on the final wine. We don't do lee steering as lee steering, you know, to get the wine fatter. We will practice lee steering to encourage the yeast at the end of the fermentation to achieve the fermentation, because with native yeast, we can't talk about quick fermentation, but we'd rather if they take 2 months or less than 6 months. And if we can help them at the end to get a bit more oxygen and to achieve the fermentation, we will do it. What we notice is definitely with round shape, you know, the sedimentation is quite fast. So as we won't touch the lees after, you know, the wine will stay like that, and you'll have a bit of movement of lees depending on the pressure, atmospheric pressure. In oval shape, we have almost a constant, like a natural lee steering, you know. You're also preserving more carbon dioxide, so we're back to the carbon dioxide. And it could be interesting some years. What I like today is mixing the two, round and oval, if I can. Mostly on the Village Cuvée or Bourgogne. The mix is quite interesting on preserving the freshness. I think it could work fine if you do 3 years of aging. It's tending to preserve a lot of the primary flavor. Oval could be too much if it's like a year with a lack of acidity. But it could be super interesting if you have a good acidity but a high alcohol level. So if I will be able to choose, you know, from 1 year to another, that will be ideal. But we can't keep the barrels empty, so usually I'm mixing.
Something that you've told me is that because of that idea about ripeness, you have to be very careful when you pick when you're going to use foudre.
Yeah, but again, it's like the closure. You shouldn't adapt. It's not because you have food that you need to pick earlier. You need to pick when it's ripe. So imagine the year doesn't suit to foudre. I still have the possibility to buy, you know, a wine that I will not sell, but just to preserve my food for 1 year. I've done it in 16, you know, with the heavy frost. I could only fill 1/3 of my barrels. But instead of losing those barrels, because I reached a point, you know, when I've started, I was buying second-hand barrels to avoid having too much new oak. But even if you buy from, you know, like good friends or top estate, they're never at your taste. Then you're bringing yeast from outside. And so today, all the barrels, you know, have been purchased by me. And in 16, I bought like a truck of Macon and we filled up the barrels with them, then sold the wine after when we were needing the barrel. And I think I was quite happy with that. So if the vintage is not good enough for the food, you know, I won't use them.
So you're getting a different kind of lees contact in those ovals in the foudre.
Mm-hmm.
And how is that affecting reduction?
You know, so far, we never suffered from reduction in the foudre. And strangely, because actually we have bigger volume, the 1,200 liters. So it's a bit more than 5 barrels. So we should, let's say, if we were thinking of reduction, it's where we should have it. I think the reduction is more due to the kind of fermentation. Early on, you were talking of nitrogen. Nitrogen is a big part of the quality of the fermentation, because the yeast are not always taking the same cycle. They don't especially eat sugar to make alcohol. They can do a different cycle. And naturally, they're producing sulfur, but it depends what kind of molecule they will produce. Good reduction, bad reduction, but usually linked with sulfur and lack of nitrogen. We're really taking care of like the must analysis we have to understand how vineyards works. And we're always trying to recorrect in the vineyards if we have a problem in the must.
So for you, what's the difference between good reduction and bad reduction?
The good reduction is it's when it's reversible. The bad one, it's when it's part of the wine. That's the main difference. And it's the same thing with oxidation, huh? This variation between red and ox, so reductive. So that's a game during all the aging of the wine. It shouldn't be always like a high protection. We're talking of sulfur, you know, against oxygen. You need some. And sometimes you can be slightly oxidative. But it has to be the right balance. If the type of molecule of sulfur you're creating are fixed, you're on the bad reduction. You know what is a bad reduction? It's when it's really going to the eggs, the bad eggs.
But you see good reduction as linked to nitrogen deficient must.
No, usually the good reduction is more linked with the lees. It's more the lees sedimentation and the amount of lees. You know, using native yeast, so if I'm talking about a 2-month fermentation or 2 weeks, it's very different. Because in 2 weeks, great, it means the yeast of the year, you know, perform very well. In terms of aromatic, it could be interesting, but it means you didn't have too many generation of yeast. And then, therefore, your amount of sediment is lower. When you have a longer fermentation, you have many more generation of yeast. And then usually you have more fine lees. And it's when you can start to have like nice reduction. It's more the lees which will bring the reduction.
What's your experience doing those ferments in steel? I know it's just been 1 year that you've been trying it.
Yeah. It's something I had in mind. And to be really fair with you, I had to do it in 18 because I didn't have enough barrels. We tried actually two tanks. One is back in barrels since February, because the reduction was going too great. To do that, you know, it's because I've been to Chablis, I've got friends in Chablis. We talked a lot about, you know, what to do, what to avoid, because when you're on a very closed tank and like stainless, you have to be careful of the quality of the lees. So one tank, not happy, and the other tank is brilliant. It's fantastic, and it's suiting so well the vintage. And I want to check a bit with stainless, just because it's not my style, but I shouldn't close the door to it, especially if we have warmer vintage. And it's more a matter to have the balance. So in the end, you know, it's the Bourgogne, it's going to be 10% of the cuvée. It's a matter to learn. The fact of having bigger volume also, it seems to work better too, because the variation of temperature is not as great than in a barrel. We have much less variation in the temperature of the wine.
When it comes to white, are you destemming or are you keeping stems before it goes to press?
Generally speaking, all bunch, all cluster, and not crushed. The question of crushing is, it's like what I was saying with the red. It shouldn't be a recipe, and destemming, not destemming, so depending on the grapes. Today, I'm definitely like from 2019, we will have a crusher. If we're reaching the type of maturity we had, I think we need to use the skin a bit more. But not everywhere. So it's not going to be like a systematic thing. But I think it could be useful in some type of maturity. So that's definitely coming in.
What do you see as the benefit of keeping stems?
It's more for the drainage.
So when it goes into the press, it presses up.
With pneumatic, we're able to do program without spinning the press, and we need the stem there to get more sediment and more phenol on the wine. I never tried actually, you know, like wine which like I love, you know, with which were made the stem in white.
How long do whites typically spend in barrel?
We do around 18 months. That's the average. We don't bottle everything at the same time. We're bottling when it's ready. There's no rule. Usually, you know, like you were talking about the white, but let's say a general rule, we're bottling white before reds. With the 17, we will finish our bottling with the whites. And usually we're starting bottling Bourgogne, then the village, Premier Cru and Grand Cru. And in 17, one of the last bottling will be with village wine. And I don't restrain myself saying, well, we can't bottle after 12 months. We've always done 18 months. So there's maybe a couple of 18 which will be bottled by harvest time because they're tasting so great now and malolactic were done straight after. But let's see what's happening in September. But we talked about very deep subject with like global warming, warmer weather, you know, type of closure. But first of all, there's a very simple thing to change in our region. First, picking dates. Of course, when you have your team, you have to use it, but sometimes you have to stop harvest if the vines are not ready. And we're talking of 100 days after flowering. That's changing a bit. So You can't decide your date of picking in June. You know approximately when it's going to be. But then you decide really at the last minute. And for me, it's the hardest point, you know, deciding when to start and which vine. And anyway, you only know if you were right 3 months later. But I think we need to manage things a bit differently today by really like picking the vine when it's ready and not because you have a team. Same thing with bottling. You don't bottle because the next harvest is coming, and you don't bottle everything at the same time, because for some wine it's a bit too late, for some wine it's going to be too early. You have to wait for the right time. And easy rule, huh? Very easy, very simple, but that's changing a lot the style and the quality of the wine.
You put the whites in the steel before you bottle them.
Right, usually yes. Not every year, but in 15, when we picked, when I looked at the wine and the acidity level, I said, well, there's no way, with higher alcohol, there's no way we can age those wine for 18 months in barrel. So straight away after, I ordered like 16 stainless steel tank. And just before the next harvest, all the 15 were in tank for the last 6-7 months. So big investment, but it did worth it because I like my 15. We were tending to, with the stainless steel, preserve a bit of a, you know, reduction, which suits well to the wine. They have some freshness. In 16, we were not really needing to use the stainless steel before bottling. So we only used them to prepare them for bottling. In 17, I used them. So there's many wine which done only 1 year in barrel and the rest in stainless.
Do you think that white Burgundy in general is more approachable at a younger age than it used to be in the 70s?
But in the 70s, you know, I was too young to try them young. So, but I can tell you about the 90s. Yes, probably. Probably at the same time, we were so much educated to drink wine when they were older. And I still love that, you know. I like my wine when they're 20 years or more. But we were not looking for young wine. But we're definitely making wine because we are so in control of many factors. There's definitely more purity on the wine. I'm not making wine to be drink young. It's not the point. I'm pretty sure they will age pretty well. But what I call a good wine is a wine which tastes well all the time. And a good vintage, great wine, you could enjoy it young. You could enjoy it, you know, with a bit of age. And you can probably enjoy it in 40, 50 years' time. Sometimes, you know, like I remember doing tasting early 90s, and the first vintage I bought was 1990. And tough vintage in some area. But I remember, like, you know, it was a lot of money for me, even if the wine was much cheaper at the time. But as a student, it was a lot. And people saying, well, you know, it's a bit hard now, but you will see in 20 years' time, you know, it's going to be great. And I tasted the first bottle after 20 years' time. Still hard. And I opened one recently, and it's still very hard. And I think it will never come, because the tannin will never get ripe on those wine. I think that the true great wine is the wine which tastes well all the time. What I love, you know, at the moment is if you work very well, you know, some underrated appellation, you could make beautiful wine which you could approach young, such as Sauce du Res or Saint-Romain. And you have also the other appellation, you know, when you're going higher. But if it's Meursault, if I'm keeping on the white, or Puligny, keep them. I'm making wine to be kept.
Let's talk about some of the crews that you work with. There's a number, but some that have really stood out for me, just to move back to red for a second, is Volnay Cayret.
It's not because of me, but it's good. Huh? Cayret is the top premier cru of Volnay. And you know what the adage in Volnay is, qui n'a jamais bu de Cayret ne connaît pas Volnay. So who never drank Cayret don't know Volnay. And I think it's pretty true. Cayret is the king of Volnay, and I'm making 4 different premier cru in Volnay. I made more premier cru in the past with Contarmont. I think I know pretty well the area, but the first time I met Cayret, I said, whoa, you know, here, there's a big difference. And a bit the same feeling than for the first time, you know, you are touching a Grand Cru from Côte de Nuit, where you say, whoa. And to be fair, you know, it's much easier to make wine on those areas than others. So there's no credit to me because most of the time the wine's making it by itself. And whatever is the vintage. I've been lucky enough to be part like of tasting where we tasted like many amazing bottles, you know, same day, all the vintages. And I'm talking of the 20s, 30s, 40s. Grand Cru from Côte de Nuit. And each time, you know, on the top three, there is a Volnay. And most of the time, it's a Cairé. And if it's not a Cairé, it's right next door. And this area is like sublime. But Cairé means, you know, it's the Cai, it's the limestone, and you can really feel it on this wine.
And another wine that you make that I like a lot is the Pommard Rougen, which you get from the Haute Rougen.
You know, we talk about my past with Contarmont. When I left Contarmont in 2014, that was just before harvest, and I really told to myself, I've done 15 vintage of Clos de Zepneaux, and I said, you know, that's it. I'll never make Pommard anymore. You know, I want to turn the page. And I said, anyway, on the one side, you know, if I do Pommard, I'd love to do Rugien. So the only vintage in my life where I haven't done Pommard was 14, and in 15... by chance, I was not looking for Rugien. It just happened to be offered. And it was part of a package with other fruits. And I said, whoa, you know, Rugien. I went to see the vineyards. And actually, this parcel is just above the Rugien bar. So as a joke, we call it Rugien du Milieu. But yeah, it's Rugien haut. You have the bottom of the vineyards looking a bit like the Rugien bar. And then you have more soil on the top, which is Rugien haut. It could be strange, but foot of the slope in Rugien Bas, you have less soil than on the mid-slope in the Rugien. And free edge of vine, so you have a good diversity. And it's the first time I used... I was wanting to do Rugien because the first time I used Old Cluster in Pommard. I always hated Old Cluster in Clos de Zepneaux, and I was not wanting to bring another layer. And again, you have very different. Very different in style and to make. Much smoother in terms of tannin extraction. And it's a bit like Cairé. Here, there's a real difference. You know, I made a lot of Pommard, and Clos de Zepneaux is a great premier cru. You know, it could reach the level of Grand Cru some vintages, but some other vintages is just a good premier cru. And I think that's the real difference between Grand Cru and premier cru. Grand Cru, whatever is the vintage, should be always at the top. Then, just beneath, you have some top premier cru. Maybe Clos de Zepneaux is part of those. Let's say if one has to be a Grand Cru, it could be Rugien, and probably more the bar than the O. So you ask me about O, I think this one is well located, but when I see the power it could bring and the elegance, and when I can taste, you know, the Rugien bar, it's in this area where you have the best. That said, I'm not sure it's reaching the level of Volnay Cairé. It's... let's see where it goes. It's not, I think in the end, it's not very important if Pommard's getting Grand Cru or not. Because what happened in the village, you know, when it started to have, you know, this wheel of having the Grand Cru, I think it was great because it's federate all the growers. And I think it's important because sometimes living in a village is not easy. And you always have like a historic little fight. And that's really brought the village all together. The result about Grand Cru or not is not very important because it did bring lots of good things to Pommard, which I think is changing a lot. It's an appellation which was difficult to understand outside, you know, the two best cru. And today there's many, many, many good producers and it's changing a lot.
I think that conversation we had earlier about extraction versus infusion, it seems like doing a little more infusion could be to the benefit of Pommard because I think the idea here is that the wines are rustic, like in the market, I mean.
Bon, Pommard, the geology over there is really red soil, more iron oxide. So naturally, we have tannin. There is tannin in Pommard. That's why it was important. I think I made better wine from 2007 at Contarmont when I've started to make wine, you know, from Côte de Nuit with my Negos side. And it made me understand differently the style of tannin we could get and we could extract. And to me, the key in my winemaking is really in 2007, when I'm starting with other appellation. And you're right, yeah. Pommard already got a lot of tannin. When I was making Clos des Epneaux at the beginning, you know, you start the fermentation and suddenly at 4-5% of alcohol, boom, you have like a big mass of tannin coming. And then it's you have another layer, and you have to deal with that. With most of the other appellation, you are building your structure bit by bit, and it's very different. So Gavin, you're definitely right. You're definitely right. With Pommard, you don't need to look for extraction. Infusion is one thing, but definitely the way to treat the harvest. You know, being well equipped, no crusher, good destemmer, or no destemmer if you want to do old bunch. But I think not all the Lieu-Dit of Pommard can afford old bunch. Again, it's going to be another layer of tannin, which it could work some vintage, but not always. To be smoother in the extraction is an interesting thing in Pommard. You know, that said, it was truly printed in the tradition of making, because Pommard, you know, the reputation of Pommard was mostly made because those wines were traveling super well. What we call rusticity today was a quality in the past. And it takes time to change.
You mentioned whole cluster there, and one of the things that was really interesting to me, we were tasting a Chambol Mousigny that you had made once, and you said you tended to destem Chambol because the vine material that's prevalent in the Chambol village tends to, for your taste, be better when it's destemmed.
I'm not sure it was with Chambol. Was it with Chambol?
That's what I wrote in my notes, but sometimes I'm wrong about things.
Now, with Chambol, sometimes I'm using old bunch. Well, maybe I know what you are meaning. I think I was talking about the coverage by village early on, but same thing. After Phylloxera, most of the time, you know, we were not like, today I will use nursery, which are more like on the northern part of France because they are free of a flavescence dorée, you know, of the disease, which means they can produce our vine without any insecticide, which is great. So I'd rather have organic plant, you know, from the beginning than being in other region, but we can order them from far. After Phylloxera, usually people were doing their own grafting or they had one nursery by village. But you can see that the selection was really made by village. For example, Von Romane, you know, like beautiful material. But you could see it was coming from the same selection. Chambol, slightly different selection, but usually it's pretty nice. Then in Gevrey, different, but different soil too. Huh? But there's definitely like a common side to all like the, you know, the oldest vine and the vine which were planted right after. Then when clonal selection arrived, you know, same thing. Depending by village, they have that type of clone. So it means that within the technique we're using in winemaking per village, yeah, by village, you can usually generalize your winemaking because you are dealing with the same material. And for me, the place where I can use easily the most old cluster is definitely Von Romane. Of course, because of the geology and the terroir, but because of the material. We're dealing usually with type of Pinot Noir, which are crazy good. And you found them again, most of the time on the northern part of Nuit-Saint-Georges. Of course, Flagey-Chezeaux in Vougeot. Chambol is a mix. And then when you're going north, usually the bunch are getting a bit bigger. I'm talking of generally speaking. Of course, you have some great material because you can have maybe some growers from Vaughan who planted in Gevrey. But for the oldest vine, usually, no, they were using the local material.
That was what really struck me when I went to Vaughan for the first time because, you know, so many times in the New World, you see Pinot Noir and the fruit is kind of big, the size of the berry. And some of the Vaughan fruit was so small. I'd never seen Pinot Noir that looked like that before. Now, obviously, I've been back, but the first time was really astounding. You make a particularly good Von Romani, Malkensor de Sioux.
Yeah, it's a great place. So au-dessus de Malkensor, of course, it's got its name from its location. Huh? It's just above the Malkensor. Different geology because here you're just on the rock and the bedrock. Of course, more minerality, but it's more to be compared with, you know, Regnault, Petit Mont than Malkensor. We're making 1.5 barrel to 1 barrel. When I tasted this wine the first time, so it was at my supplier, and I said, whoa, you know, that's got so much lift. And I was not even aware exactly how it was. where was Odessu de Malconsort? You know, it's a tiny place. But it's something I love. I love hunting those lieux-dits which are not well known, either because there's only one owner or because it's too small. Or I do the same, we know, with Goulot in Gevrey or Tête du Clos in Chassagne. And yeah, I quite like this, but it was a good deal because it was just before harvest. And, you know, like being a négociant is also it's a very rich adventure in terms of human relationship. And he said, oh, yeah, maybe one day I'll sell you the Malconsort, but I'll sell you it in wine. I said, that's the only barrel you've got, so why do you want to take the risk to take it? And he said, I'd love to have it in fruit. And he said, oh, no, I'm not selling fruit. I said, hey, come on. And yeah, an hour later, it was done. And making this wine the first time, just crazy. So you realize the power of what Von Romanée could make. And I never made any Richebourg or Romanée Saint-Vivant, so of course I'm not talking about the two Grand Cru above. But such a dream. Everything is there. This village is really, really gifted.
I remember one time you said Vaughan is magic.
Yeah, it is magic. It is magic, and there's something there that you can't find elsewhere. Of course, you have some amazing crew, you know. I love Clos Saint-Denis for other reason, but over there, it's just magic. Magic is the white world.
You mentioned how that part of Vaughan is a little higher up on the slope, and somewhere else where you're a little higher up is in the parcel of Clos Saint-Denis that you have, where you're actually kind of on the border with Chaffaut there.
Yeah, actually, and we are producing Chaffaut from the same parcel. You know, we like in Burgundy saying we are next to. Our Chaffaut is next to Clos Saint-Denis, but it's definitely a premier cru. It's not got the level of the Grand Cru. Clos Saint-Denis is interesting because it's not always the Grand Cru we're thinking of. But if Maurice Saint-Denis took Saint-Denis as to complement its name, there's a reason. It's such a Grand Cru with such a lift, and it's very different than the other Grand Cru from this village. Clos Saint-Denis got an elegance that I really, really, really like. You're slightly higher and more mineral on Chaffaut than Clos Saint-Denis. I like Maurice Saint-Denis a lot. I like the aromatic and the lift you have on the aroma in Maurice Saint-Denis. And that's why I like a big part of my Gevrey is actually coming from alongside Maurice Saint-Denis. I like this area. It's very underrated, actually, strangely.
Somewhere you're particularly strong is in the Gevrey-Chambertin area. And you make a range of Grand Crus, including Mazy Chambertin, Griot Chambertin, and Lay Chambertin, that are, I think, some of your best wines in red.
A Chambertin, alors, first of all, Gevrey Chambertin is one of the largest appellations. Hein? With Brochon, it's like bone. Hein? It's reaching almost 500 hectares. So it was, in some aspect, you know, easier to get in this village. It's much easier to get into Gevrey than Chambolle-Musigny. That's why first I started there. I started in 2007 with only village. Hein? Interesting enough, I started only with like the Moray side. And then with talking with some growers, they said, you know, you should bring a bit of the north. And then bit by bit, I built my village cuvée with all the diversity of Gevrey, which I kept. And by working with different suppliers, you know, I had the opportunity to get some Grand Cru. So started with Mazoyer, actually, Chambertin. I was really wanting to keep Mazoyer because for me, there's a real difference between Mazoyer and Chambertin. Geology is different. The style of wine.
So just to explain, Mazoyer can be labeled as Chambertin on the bottle, you don't do that.
So it's like a one-way road. You can call Mazoyer Charm, but you can't call Charm Mazoyer. It's how it is. Mazoyer and Charm are about the same area. There's a bit more Mazoyer than Charm. You see it more and more on label, you know, where people call the Mazoyer. Sometimes Charme les Mazoyères, but you know, when the market was like mostly French, Charme Chambertin it's a nicer name. Huh? It's Charme, it's charming. And but today in the cellar, I've got Charme and Mazoyer. I've got both and different style. I like, you know, Charme is more generous, is more approachable, when Mazoyer is deeper, more complex, slightly more spicy. Funny enough, I don't know which one of the Grand Cru of Gevrey is the best. It depends on the year. Most of the time, let's say the Chambertin is the biggest. This wine is always taking its time in terms of aging. It's not the wine will be show off, you know, in the cellar, but when it's reaching, you know, maturity, so at least 18 months, it's the most powerful. But it's a, you know, it's a very silent king. You know, he's not showing off. He's not showing, you know, like big muscle, but he's imposing. And when you try it at his best, he's like, whoa. Then depending on the vintage, you know, I've got one coming above the others. I'm saying that, but that said, Mazoyer is almost the same every year. And I like Mazoyer for that. It's not the biggest. He's not showing a lot, but he's always at his level. You know, if I have to pick up a Grand Cru sometimes, and I'm not sure about because it's young, I will pick up Mazoyer from a younger age, because it's always going to give something. Then you have a Griotte Chambertin. Alors, we are on top and underneath, because here there's a little depression, a hole, which from an old quarry, you know, where they're extracting stone. So, mean that those vines are actually growing on an older bedrock. And here, you don't play with tannin. It's just pure lift and aromatics. And a very different style. You know, you can look at the Chambertin or the Griotte from... you can walk from one vineyard to another, but so, so different. And when it's at its best, it's a wine that you don't even need to drink. You can just smell the glass and get drunk of the smell. And Mazy Chambertin is the one in between. So we have Mazy Haut and Mazy Bas together. And Gevrey's got a large area of Grand Cru. But there's no doubt about the quality.
It seems like there's a lot of old vines in Gevrey. Like, a lot of people seem to have vines in the 90, 100, 120-year-old age.
I was talking about the selection where there's slightly bigger grapes than Vaughan, but they were definitely, you know, for most of them, free of virus, and aging well. If you don't have any virus, you don't have to pull out the vine, and if you can pull bit by bit and replace, and no problem with that.
Moving to white, you make some Grand Cru white. Awesome wine. But one of the things that's so interesting about you is some of the less heralded whites are really interesting. And so I wonder if we could talk about, for example, San Roman, Auxey d'Arès, and Blany.
I love those appellations, and it's definitely one part of my development. I think there's still a part of Burgundy which needs to be discovered, where you have great terroir, not to make Grand Cru, of course. You were talking of Grand Cru, I'd love to make Chevalier Montrachet one day. But I've got so much excitement working with Auxey d'Arès and San Roman. And above that, the human relationship, it's so much easier to deal with growers on those appellations, because there's so much more freedom there. Freedom on every aspect. There's much more interaction. I'm not saying you don't have it with Grand Cru, but it's also coming to myself. When you're dealing with Grand Cru, you know, especially with one barrel of Mazy and... you shouldn't make it wrong, quoi. So I'm not saying I'm playing it safe, but of course, unconsciously, yeah, you keep a bit of security. When we have a petition, I don't have to. I was talking with Saroma doing vertical press. And if you treat them well and you do the right viticulture like you will do in Meursault, it works. It works well. And on top of that, with warmer weather, there's a super great future there. Then, talking about Blany, it's part of our estate. We have a single vineyard of 2.2 hectares. Blany is such a wonderful place. I mean, I'm talking about the place. I'm not talking about making wine, just to be there. I mean, suddenly you're outside the Côte de Beaune. It's a real micro climate and micro area with a different, I mean, even the animals are different, you know. And you feel good when you're there. The wine, for me, Blany has got a true identity, and the system of appellation, I understand why in the past, if it's white, you call it Meursault, if you're on the Pulini side, you call it Pulini, if it's red, you call it Blany, but there's truly there two geology, one for Pinot, one for Chardonnay, and through years, you know, like, many of the Pinot has been pulled out to replant Chardonnay. Quite easy to understand, because most of the time Blany was owned by a Meursault producer. So when you only do one red, it's a bit difficult to be well equipped and to manage that. And on top of that, Chardonnay is cropping higher. Selling Meursault is probably a higher price than a Blenny Red. So that said, I want to pull out some Chardonnay and replant Pinot.
Well, you make a good Blenny Rouge, actually. I mean, we didn't talk about it when we were doing Reds, but you're near Matro, right? And they're classic for
Yes, La Pièce sous le Bois, yeah, same thing. Matro is an example, you know, because I've been able to taste some older vintages and they're always great. But on top of that, I mean, the bottom of the slope is a terroir for Pinot. You can't mix it up. Chardonnay is doing well everywhere, but it's not doing as well than on Chardonnay geology. And on top of that, as the white can't be called Blanny, you can call them Meursault Blanny, but you know, you're losing the appellation. When I'm putting my Meursault Premier Cru La Pièce sous le Bois alongside my Meursault Genévrière or Charme, I think it hasn't got really its place. But on its own, yeah, it's got a saltiness that the others don't have. I'd love to call my white Blanny, Blanny Premier Cru, and have the choice. I mean, you can have the choice of calling it Meursault Puligny or Blanny. That will be the right thing. But, you know, it's like Saint-Aubin. Saint-Aubin is not like Puligny. And today, I mean, Saint-Aubin, there's no doubt. It's a great terroir and everybody recognizes the appellation. But Blanny is another terroir which needs to be recognized. And what I like with Blanny Red is, since I'm making it, so 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, slightly different vintages. Always great. Adapting to any kind of situation. So I trust in Blenny. I will fight for this appellation. I understand the market is not ready, but it's a question of education. And in 20 years' time, you know, that will be the past. We'll say, you know, why at the time no one was wanting Blenny? That's such a great place.
From a negociant perspective, what does it look like? Meursault, Sessan Mauricé, Puligny Mauricé. How do they differ?
Well, I've got three different situations. In Meursault, it's where I've got most of my vineyard. So over there, I'm more like a grower than a négociant. At the same time, it's a larger appellation. You have lots of good producer. There's some common side between different growers, mostly Dami as a cooperage. Which shoots well, huh? Because same thing, huh? Dami grew up with the appellation, so I think it is probably one of the best to supply Meursault. But Meursault, larger area, bigger diversity of terroir, so it's easier to work on a large area as a négociant perspective. Puligny, because historically there were no sellers, always worked with the négos, but it's a smaller appellation. And you always worked with the négos, you know, when I arrived, there were not much room. So in Puligny, I'm working a little bit, but not an easy place to make your room. But Puligny, in a way, I was talking about, you know, the magic Von Romane. You have places in Puligny which are magic. And Chassagne, well, I've got a little vineyards. I've got my Bâtard, Montrachet over there. And Chassagne, a village with like, I think in this village, like people are really working together. And you can see it when you're in the village. You know, for whatever reason, when there's a village party, everybody's together. You know, it's a village that seems to have no fight at all. And it's great to work there.
And then I wonder if we could just talk about soil a little bit. Sometimes you've alluded to the soil health as changing during different periods of Burgundy.
I think one of the key things is to plow the soil and not using herbicide. If you want to talk about terroir, that's the first thing. Of course, when you have vineyards, you know, you always got the question, why are you not doing an estate label and you have the négos label? But the vineyards I bought, you know, usually were not in great shape because the vineyards for sale are not coming from the top estate. The vineyards I took 6 years ago, you know, they had probably 30 years of herbicide. There were nothing growing for 3 years. And it's quite amazing how fast it's coming back. Faster when you have limestone and so more on the cru side. When you have deeper clay like in Bourgogne, it takes more time. But you know, like what happened in Burgundy in the last 40 years with chemicals and herbicide is reversible. It will take much less than 40 years to bring it back. And I think when you're coming to Burgundy today, you see in spring, you know, you don't see. It's not like 5 years ago where you could see, you know, like burn grass with herbicide. you have more and more people, you know, plowing the soil and respecting that. And that will be a big improvement. Then the next step, of course, is to be organic, to bring life back to the soil faster. But even if you don't get organic straight away, you make a big step by stop using herbicide. Now, of course, you will have effect on the wine. Like one of the rules, you never plow the soil like at least 4 weeks before harvest. If not, you can be sure you will bring back some dirt, humidity, and you can get botrytis. Same thing when the grape is like closing down. If you bring the dirt inside the bunch, it's how you inoculate the bunch from inside.
Looking back over the run of vintages since you started your own Negociant and Domaine business in 2007, there's been some warm vintages there. There's been some hail vintages there. There have been some couple of cool vintages, and there's been some frost. And when you look across that run of vintages, what are particular learning moments that stand out for you?
I always adapt myself. What I was trying to create with the winery is to be able to face any kind of situation. And most of the time, we're lucky enough to be sometimes over-equipped, but I suffered so much in 2003, you know, when we picked with high temperature, even if we were picking in the morning, because the night it was not cooling down, and I was not equipped at the time at the winery in Pommard. And I think I could have done better, but lack of equipment. So I've learned mostly to adapt myself. I mean, you have ideas, you want to do things, but if you don't have the material in front of you, don't do it. You know, like during harvest, we always got like people coming to help. And most of the time, you know, they are young winemakers, or sometimes they are winemakers with skill and experience. And many times they ask me this question, but, what is your image of the wine you want to make? And I said, I've got no clue. I don't have an image before. It's like bit by bit, the color's coming, and the image, the final image will be at the end. But before that, I want to see what's exactly on the fruit. I can't ask something which is not there. I'm really working always this way. So it's the best approach to when you have new situation. You were talking of a frost. So like in 16, for example, we have two different vintage in one. You have the vineyards with frost and the vineyards which had no frost, because Pommard, Volnay were totally fine. And we had to have two different approaches in terms of winemaking, but that was not planned before. That's the best way. No preconcept. If you already have a preconcept because you said, oh, I've seen this before, actually, every year is different. So for me, I never got an image, you know, and we're talking of infusion, but maybe I will need 1 year to extract a bit more because the potential is there, or because there's not enough potential, I don't know. I'm working, you know, like hours by hours, day by day, and learn with it.
Ben LaRue knows he likes the smell of flowers, and he knows he likes the smell of Gruyère. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you, Levy.
Ben LaRue of Benjamin LaRue, based in Beaune in Burgundy in France. Knowing Benjamin LaRue as I do, I know that Blagny is really his spot and how close it is to his heart. It's an area of the Côte de Beaune where he has purchased vineyards for himself, and he is one of today's foremost proponents of Blagny for structured, ageable reds from Pinot Noir that exhibit the limestone of the area in the texture of the finished wine. Red Blagny is also something that I'm really fond of myself, and so it's gratifying to me to be able to offer listeners the Benjamin LaRue Blagny Premier Cru La Piste sous Bois Rouge 2016 for the discounted price of $69.95 a bottle. That's about $10 off the normal price, and this discounted deal is specifically for those of you who use the promo code IDTTFORME with the podcast retail partner Crush Wine and Spirits. For sure, this is a chance to buy now a wine that you will be hearing more and more about in the future. And this is a Côte de Beaune red with crunchy minerality as well as delicious fruit. For some 2016 Blagny Rouge, call Crush at 212-980-9463 and use the offer code IDTTFORME, or use that same promo code online at crushwineco.com. You can also send me an email at levyopenswine levi@gmail.com. That's L-E-V-I, opens with an S, wine@gmail.com. If you'd like to join our wine club, and then I'll make sure that some of Benjamin LaRue's delicious Blanc Rouge from 2016 makes its way to you. We have show t-shirts, bags, and coffee mugs available. If you'd like to wear what you hear, go to illdrinktothatpod.com, that's I-L-L, drinktothatpod.com, and hit the t-shirts tab. And you'll see our full selection of All Drink to That shirts, sweaters, bags, cups, and prints, all of that in a range of sizes, colors, and styles. Check them out on the illdrinktothatpod.com website.
I've read, you know, that, and I heard also, that before Phylloxera, it was pretty common to have a small percentage of aligoté planted together with Chardonnay. And I think it's quite interesting, you know, because maybe it's an answer to the freshness and to the acidity. And why not? I'm not saying we're doing it because we're not allowed to do it, but if you have a few complotation, you know, of aligoté on your cru, why not? So that's why we need also to preserve the best aligoté, because they might be helpful for the other variety we're growing. I'm not against that idea.